open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
There's a point in every writer's life where the only person that believes in you is you. Even my parents, who are the best parents in the world, there was a point where they're like, you should probably get a job.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Author and journalist Drew Philp says you really can't be free unless your neighbors are also free.
When I'm watching my neighbors get foreclosed on and people losing their homes at a rate of 1 out of every 3, and also people losing their water, 1 out of every 6 homes in Detroit has lost access to fresh water. There is a huge responsibility to that, and you can never really be free when you're seeing this.
At age 23, Drew Philp moved to Detroit and bought a house for $500. He spent the next few years renovating it, living without heat or electricity. Drew wrote a book about his experience called A $500 House in Detroit, Rebuilding an Abandoned Home and an American City. He talks this hour with WTCM News Talk 580 radio host Ron Jolly. Ron asked Drew where he grew up.
I grew up in Adrian, Michigan. Which is about here on the hand, to a pretty blue-collar family. My father was a tradesman, and he taught machine trades at a Votech, at a tech center. I was lucky enough to be able to go to the University of Michigan, and at the time, I graduated in 2008, and at the time, everyone was leaving the state. Like 75% of U of M graduates were leaving the state. This is at the height of the Great Recession. And I felt very, very lucky to get the education that I did, coming from the family that I did. And I wanted to use that for something positive at home. So that's when I decided to move to Detroit, and everybody told me I was throwing my life away.
Yeah. What are you doing that for? Why did you move to Detroit? How familiar were you with Detroit, especially the area that you moved in?
So I was really not familiar at all. The time I'd spent in Detroit was going to, like, dirty punk shows at clubs, and then you go in and out. So I didn't have a lot of familiarity, but the reason I moved there was because, you know, Detroit is not only the heartbeat of Michigan and the Midwest, it is arguably the heartbeat of the United States itself. It was the city that invented the middle class with Henry Ford and his $5 a day. It was the America's fourth largest city at one point, and now it's not even in the top 20.
No.
And it has this metaphorical power that other cities just don't have. Practically, it also meant that what I did in Detroit would reverberate around the state and around the region, you know, to my cousin framing out houses in Kalamazoo, or my sister who's a nurse in Lansing. Mm.
Detroit, though, I remember a friend of mine gave me a sweatshirt years ago, and the graphic was you were looking down the barrel of a pistol, and it said, "Welcome to Detroit, where the weak are killed and eaten."
Yeah.
It kind of has that image, and you're moving in at a real downturn in the economy.
Sure, certainly.
Did you have a goal at that point when you first moved there?
You know, what I had said at that point was, I don't know what I want to do, but I know that I want to do that in Detroit.
Just wanted to be in Detroit.
That was my goal, to stay in Michigan at all costs. Because like I said, I felt really lucky to get this world-class education, and I really wanted to use it to try to do something at home for my people here. You know, everybody seemed to be moving to New York or San Francisco or Paris. And I'm a Michigan boy. My whole family's from here. We all live here. I thought that was important that I stuck around.
So you moved to, which I didn't know they don't call it the Cass Corridor anymore, but that's where you moved and had crack dealers and prostitutes as your neighbors?
That's true. Yeah. Yes. It was Detroit is changing now. Detroit is a very different place than it was even 10 years ago. But at the time, it was the Detroit that everybody here thinks of, and that was real. However, no one ever treated me poorly. I got treated wonderfully by all kinds of people. I lived in an apartment building in the corridor, and my neighbors were literally crack dealers and prostitutes and former prostitutes that would look out for me, that had kind of taken a shine to me, and we would sit on the stoop and drink, and I smoked cigarettes at the time, and smoke, and everyone really looked out for me.
Yep. So, although a big change from Ann Arbor, from Lenawee County, Adrian area, Welcoming, and then you took the next step of laying down roots and buying a house. What led you to say, not I'm going to buy a house, but I'm going to buy one that's barely standing for $500, and I'm going to bring it to life? What made you do that?
So I was working in construction. I was sanding floors for $8.50 an hour, laying floors. I really like the people I work with, but that's a real hard job, especially for that kind of money. And I was working on all these cheap rentals that people were buying, because you could buy a house for nothing at the time. You still can in Detroit. And that kind of got me thinking, like, wow, why am I paying rent? Making $8.50 an hour, I should buy one of these and live in it. I thought, one, it was a good financial decision, but also that it would keep me tied to Detroit and Michigan, because everything I owned at that time would fit in my Jeep. And I could go. And Detroit's not the easiest city to live in still. So I wanted something that tied me there.
What was the neighborhood that you moved into, Poletown or Poletown East? Is it Poletown? What was it like in 08 when you first went there and met some of the people who had bought and rehabbed some of these houses? Can you paint a picture of how many houses on a block, what the conditions were?
Sure. So if anybody here is familiar with Detroit, I live in Poletown. It's just east of Eastern Market. And it is a triangle. It's in a triangle bordered by freeways and Gratiot Avenue, which is a main thoroughfare, that's only residential. And that neighborhood has a population density of 90% less than Detroit as a whole. Detroit is already a half-empty city, and that's even less. At the time when I moved in there, you could throw a stone in any direction and hit an abandoned house. And these are legitimately abandoned houses. I did look at some foreclosures, three-story brick houses that I could have bought and moved into for $3,000. But I couldn't bring myself to profit off of someone else's misery like that. One in three houses in Detroit has been foreclosed on. And that's not a crisis of personal responsibility when it's one in three. That's something systemic and wrong. So the neighborhood was positively rural, except for these kind of crumbling American ruins. I don't think there was anything like it elsewhere in the United States, just these tombstones of houses that people had once loved and once cared for were just abandoned. I used to be able to walk my dog. This is a bike ride from the baseball stadium in one of America's largest and most important cities, and not be able to see a soul for an hour.
What kind of wildlife was out in the neighborhood there?
This is true. Yeah. So a kind of mascot for Detroit is now the pheasant, because we have pheasants. Pheasants are big birds. I've seen foxes. I almost hit one on my motorcycle, actually. That was not that great. My buddy Will, who's a character in my book, swears that he saw a deer. Again, this is a major American city. I sit out on the porch at night with my girlfriend, and we listen to the crickets and the insects.
Yep. So I want to ask about Will, because Drew's story is it strikes me, because it's just a matter of kind of following your heart, following your principles, not really knowing where it's going to lead you, and it led him here to the stage of the National Writers Series. He does TED Talks in New York and travels the world and writes for The Guardian. And you didn't know that when you got out of school. You just followed yourself. So tell me about how you met Will and how that kind of led you to buy one of these houses.
So to be honest with you, I kind of thought that I might have been throwing my life away too. I certainly did not expect any of this, nor did I expect to write a book.
Yeah.
But meeting Will is an interesting kind of story. I was living in an apartment, and I really didn't have many friends. I was very, very lonely. I moved to Detroit with no money, no job, and no friends at all. Just basically with nothing, with what I had in my back almost. And I decided to go to a Halloween party dressed as an organ grinder, like an old-timey organ grinder that like grinds the organ, right? And I made this pretty sweet organ that played Motown music. And because I was making $8.50 an hour, I had hidden some liquor inside the organ to drink at the party, so I didn't have to buy it, which is kind of shameful, but I don't regret it. So I had set my organ down to go dance. I really like to dance, interestingly enough. And I had come back to get an illicit swig of this Rock Gut whiskey, and sitting next to my organ was a person dressed up as an organ grinder's monkey. honestly, and it seemed very, very meant to be. And he was kind of all knotted up and uncomfortable. He's really a misanthrope, and he didn't want to be there. We went outside and began talking, and I said, I want to buy a house in East Detroit, in this neighborhood that I'd kind of been exploring on my own. And he said, I just did. It seemed very meant to be. He had lived in Detroit a decade before that, so 20 years ago, and was like, Kid Rock had lived in the same building downtown. It was a really pretty wild time, and he had been traveling the country. He was kind of a punk, so he was like riding freight trains around and living in Asheville and New Orleans, and he had come back and purchased this house for $3,000 from a Detroit police officer. It was his mother's house, and she had died in there. It was the only house in the block except for a weird, ugly project house that was across the street that somebody had built and also abandoned.
So you read, when you saw Will's home, you said it's the coolest thing I've ever seen, and to you it equaled freedom.
Yeah, it looks like it was like a tree house, right? You know, I was 23, and you can buy a house for $3,000 or $5,000, and he was living there. When he got there, you know, he didn't have any water, so he was mopping the floor with rainwater and just kind of figuring things out, really divorced from what was going on in the rest of American culture. So I lived with him that summer. He let me live with him while I was looking for a house for free, which was very, very kind. And we were very cut off from things. So it was before smartphones. Yeah. So neither of us had a smartphone. We didn't have the internet. We certainly didn't have television. The only kind of connection to the outside world we had was the radio.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful. It was one of the most beautiful times in my life. But from that, we would ride our bikes just around the neighborhood and look for houses and go into these wild, abandoned houses and look for something that looked good.
And so you found one there. And back to motive here. So you're 23 and it looks like a tree house and you can make your own and you can buy it cheap and carve out your own life in Detroit. And there's more of a statement, too, that I think you make throughout your book. Zeno, I want to ask you about Zeno, was a crack dealer from the old place where you first lived. Mm. And you write, he invited you, he called you up one day and says, can you go to the hospital with me? And they had a little chapel in the hospital, I guess, and Zeno and his wife or girlfriend had a service for their stillborn baby, and they invited you along. What impact did that have on you, and how did that inspire you, if at all, to stay in Detroit?
Oh, man, I forgot about that until just now. That was hard. So, Zeno and his girlfriend, Sue, I call them in the book, had a stillborn baby, and they invited me to the funeral, and it was a 3-4-person funeral. There was a preacher, and there was Zeno and Sue, and there was me. I think Zeno wanted to show me something. And I don't know exactly what that was, but I remember that baby staring at me. It's an image that I have burned into my brain that I will never be able to forget. Because Sue wanted to see her son for the last time before they put him in the ground. They took all of the blankets off the child. And it had... Sorry, this is a little difficult, you know. It convinced me that how can you leave? How can you leave that? I've been given so much privilege and had so much luck and worked so hard to get the education that I do and to read and have a family that supports me almost unconditionally. My parents are just wonderful, strange people. So to have that, I realized that I just couldn't go. I couldn't go away.
That's a weird feeling, though. Did you feel some kind of obligation to some individuals you knew, or to just symbolically to some people that you would abandon them if you left Detroit?
Yeah. So Detroit is a city of leaving. You know, people just leave, and that's really what the problem is, right? When you get down to it, it's that simple and that complex. I don't think it's obligation. I think it's responsibility is what I think. And I think that I have a responsibility not only to Detroit and to Michigan, but to the United States and our world. I think we're facing a lot of enormous challenges right now. And I always think that I can't really be free unless my neighbors are free as well. So when I'm watching my neighbors get foreclosed on and people losing their homes at a rate of 1 out of every 3, and also people losing their water, 1 out of every 6 homes in Detroit mm-hmm. has lost access to fresh water. This is on the world's largest source of it. You can spit into the world's largest source of fresh water from Detroit. There was a huge responsibility to that, and you can never really be free when you're seeing this. I think that's a lesson that we've forgotten in this country a little bit.
So it would have been easy to leave, maybe for sure. A lot of people to say, this is too much of a hassle, it's too depressing.
Sure.
I want to get out and
sure.
use my degree and get a nice job, but well, you know, did not.
I don't know. It sounds foolish and silly, I suppose, and old-fashioned maybe, but,
yeah.
you know, I try to do the right thing, and that's what my parents taught me, and I don't know. It's the truth, and it's that simple, and it's that complex.
So the neighborhood you described, it was kind of it's right outside of downtown Detroit, stone's throw from the freeway, and there, you know, farming is going on there. People are farming.
Yeah, people are farming. And we're baling hay.
Yeah. You were baling hay out there.
Right, yeah.
fields of alfalfa. What was that, I don't know, 50 years ago, say, do you know what the neighborhood was before it became what it is?
Sure, 50 years ago, the neighborhood, their houses would have been packed in like matchsticks.
Yeah.
It is an ethnically Polish neighborhood, although before that it was an Italian neighborhood, and before that it was a Jewish neighborhood. There are 2 churches on the National Register of Historic Places in the neighborhood. One is St. Stanislaus, which is completely abandoned and wide open.
Hmm.
The other is St. Albertus, which they're trying to bring back, and they use maybe once a month. People legitimately used to mortgage their homes to build these churches. People loved this place. They were built to rival the cathedrals in Europe, so I'm talking like gold leaf and marble. And it was one of the original areas of white flight, and people moved away, in many cases, literally abandoning their house, which is what I bought. My house had been abandoned for at least 10 years.
So do you feel what you did and what your neighbors there did by rehabbing these houses and staying put with all the challenges is a credit to, or it's bringing the city back? I mean, you feel like, suppose 100,000 people
sure.
did that, what shape the city would be in?
I mean, I think we should certainly support it. And we also need to support the people that are actually there and have stuck around too. I couldn't have done any of this without the people that have stuck around. You know, there's sometimes a thought when we get to talking about this kind of pioneer things that, you know, that I'm a pioneer. I'm not. There were people there way, way before me, people that have stuck around, seen a lot harder things that I have, and they deserve a lot of credit too. And sometimes there's also a myth that those people can't move out, and that's just what it is, a myth. People that have been in Detroit, I call them generational Detroiters, for a long time, they very much care about the city too. And we need to have, they need to have a large role in deciding what the city becomes as it's changing. And I think that as a society, you know, governments need to support not only the new folks like me coming in, but the people that have been there for a while too.
Mm-hmm. What the knock on Detroit is the safety issue, the crime issue. What can you tell us about that in your neighborhood or living there? Is that a legitimate issue, or did you have to deal with any threats or crime?
Sure. Yes. I mean, the safety is always a legitimate issue. It is a dangerous city. There are like 3 carjackings a day or something there. However, crime generally stays within its own group. If crime is, despite what the news says, crime is generally not random. Although that does happen, sometimes that happens. The vast majority of crime is not random. So it is, in that sense, much safer. With that said, you know, nobody there is untouched by crime. People don't have jobs. There's nothing for young men to do or to feel good about. And they largely have no other choice. So I did have someone try to kick in my door one day. And that was terrifying. Not only in the fact that I was scared for myself and my own personal safety, I had a gun and I would have shot that person had he, I assume it was a he, I never saw the person come into my house. That's a huge thing. You go to Detroit and you want to do good and then you end up shooting someone. That's not great.
You were reluctant to get a gun, weren't you?
I was a little bit. I grew up, in a rural family. Like we grew up hunting and fishing and stuff. And I had to make a kind of real decision about that. And I cannot get the police to come to my house when I call them. I mean, maybe they would come sometimes. The last time my neighbor called the police on my behalf, I generally do not call the police for a number of reasons, but they did not show up.
Yeah, so your experience with the police in that neighborhood overall was not good?
I mean,
or just an incident or two?
I mean, these men and women are doing a really difficult job. Yep. So my dad was I certainly don't hate police. My dad was a police officer in the summers. I have two uncles that were police officers. The starting salary for a Detroit cop is just wildly low.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like $12 an hour or something. I mean, it's something ridiculous. Yeah. Don't quote me on that number, but it is something absurdly low. They're doing a really difficult job. You know, it's definitely not the beat cop's fault that, you know, that they're coming. They got a lot of stuff to do. But there has been some serious mismanagement on the governmental level. And that's not just Detroit. That's the state of Michigan, and that's the federal government that, you know, we're not providing adequate resources for the most basic of necessities of our citizens in America. I mean, think about that. That's terrifying. You know, during the bankruptcy, we cut back the pensions of people who had worked for, in some cases, 30 years for the city, and were promised that as part of their salary, and we cut that back. It's terrifying to me that America can't make its promises.
Live up to the obligations there. I was gonna say, too, with the safety feature, so if on your block, if there were just the residents who were left, who had been there a long time and left, and nobody knew like yourself and your friends that you met there and rehab these houses, it probably would have been a prime area for crime. I mean, was it a positive impact that you feel that you guys had just by bringing some vibrancy to the neighborhood?
You know, I think so. I think it's all a. I'm certainly not gonna claim that. You know, what I did was I took one abandoned house. Nobody can get dragged into that house. That house can't burn down. Now, it can burn down still, but not in some kind of abandonment thing. Sure, it's definitely safer with more eyes, but I'm certainly not gonna take credit for, you know, the safety of the neighborhood. It's really a team effort. So I have many of my neighbors are elderly, and you know, they help out. They're, you know, sitting on the porch a lot when it's nice out, and they're keeping eyes on everything. They're around during the day when people are at work. Myself, another young man that in the book I call King. If there's problems, we deal with them. I'm not gonna send my elderly old female neighbor to, you know, talk to the guy scrapping the house out, right? That's kind of my job. So we all work together.
So I was gonna say, so when there's vibrancy in the neighborhood, does it become a target because now there are people that have things that, or is it the reverse effect where they know you're looking out for each other?
I think they know we're looking out for each other, but in my neighborhood in particular, I don't see too big of a problem with that yet. What I do see is in the city at large. Mm-hmm. So as more young white people move into the city, we're having classes rub up against each other in a way that they were not before. So you have some people who are, in many cases, in desperate, near third world poverty. We're talking about people without water. Next to people working for Dan Gilbert and tech people making, you know, in some cases $100,000 a year. They're looking to Detroit as a place that is exciting. And when you have those things rub up against each other, the have and the have-nots, that can cause problems.
All right. Well, what's your thought about then? I mean, if you've seen that and see that as a problem, what could we do about that?
I think the first and foremost, the money that we spend there needs to be allocated more responsibly. So just a week after Detroit declared bankruptcy, a week after Detroit said it was a bankrupt city, we gave Mike Ilitch, the owner of the Red Wings and the Tigers, $350 million to build a hockey stadium. Economists agree on basically nothing, and this is conservative and liberal economists, this crosses all divides, and agree that is a raw deal. So I think that if we really want Detroit to come back for everyone, for Detroiters, and in addition to people coming in, because, you know, like myself, we can allocate that, we can use that money a lot more sensibly and a lot more critically, frugally, and innovatively. So for example, Detroit is a food desert, which means that people have trouble getting access to fresh food. I have trouble getting access to fresh food. I have to drive quite a ways to get to a grocery store. With that money, Detroit could have planted fruit trees around the city, free for everyone to eat from. Detroit could have put solar panels on everyone's house, basically.
What would you say? Is that $500,000 loans? What would you get out of that?
If we want to keep it in capitalism, we want to keep it in that money in economic development, you can make 700 half-million-dollar
small business grants
and loans, right? That's a lot of money. Detroit would be a completely different place with 700 new small businesses. This is stuff that we can do on the state and national level too. We can think like this and we can support people that are sitting out in the audience right now to do things instead of giving money to a billionaire for a hockey stadium that doesn't really change anything.
I lived downtown 1979 through 83-ish, and Jefferson Avenue, I'm trying to think of a cross street, well, right by I-75 there. When I went shopping, I had a Farmer Jack's, which was terrible. It was just a really dirty store, and it was not always open when it was supposed to be. So I went to the burbs to go shopping, which was the case right until I think Whole Foods. I mean, where did you go shop for grocery shopping?
There is one great independent grocery store there called Honeybee Market, which is in Southwest, which is like the Mexican part of town. It's near what we call Mexican Town. Honeybee Market was great, so I usually went to Honeybee. And there is also some great independent grocery stores in Hamtramck, ethnic grocery stores, Polish and Islamic grocery places that are just great. But until 2009, the last Farmer Jack closed there, and I forget what year it was. Until 2009, Detroit didn't have a single national chain grocery store until Whole Foods came. And Whole Foods itself is perhaps, and I'm guessing here, the most subsidized grocery store in the United States. It was subsidized on the federal, the state, and the city levels.
Whole Foods?
That's correct.
How through?
All of those, so federal, state, and city is a subsidized.
Oh, that they get for building there.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Whole paycheck, they call it.
Whole paycheck.
Because it's not affordable for everybody.
Yes, I call it food hole.
So I want to talk a bit about your writing, because this is the Writers' Conference here. And before we get to that, talk about building. So you enmesh yourself in Detroit. You make the decision to be there for pretty principled reasons, passionate reasons. But realistically, you have a piece of junk. You have a beautiful frame, a Queen Anne, with no plumbing, no electricity, no windows, big holes in the roof.
Sure.
Did you have a look at it and wonder, could you really, did you have the knowledge and the fortitude to actually follow through and fix this and make it livable? Did you have doubts at any time?
I don't remember that I did. I'm sure that I did at some point, but I was probably excited for the challenge. You know, like when I was a kid, we used to build stuff. We used to build tree forts, and that's what we did for fun. I mean, I grew up in a family where there was you knew which end of the hammer to hold. Which is not always the case anymore. The days of the shop in grandpa's basement are going away. But I grew up, and that's what I did for fun. So I was legitimately excited about working on this and testing myself. I think we're seeing a crisis in masculinity right now, especially in young men. I think that's where a lot of these mass shootings are coming from. It's basically always all men. And we don't really have any rituals to place us into manhood anymore, to be able to test ourselves. The military is only 1% of families now. There's no draft, nothing like that. So we're not able to exercise our traditional masculinity. So I was very excited about that, and I was very excited to kind of take this on. Now at 31, I definitely would not want to live without heat for 2 years.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was you want to test yourself, and I wanted to see what kind of human being I was going to be.
So what was your favorite tool? Did you have a go-to tool or one that you always said, I'm really thankful I have this?
I have a favorite screwdriver, which is the stupidest thing. It's like this little red screwdriver that I got at like a little market down there. And man, it just works perfectly. It like fits right in the slots and like feels good in your hand. Yep. I remember telling my buddy Chris, a buddy of mine who was helping me on the house, that's my favorite screwdriver. And he was like, okay, Drew, I'm not going to break it.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Drew Philp talks about how he turned his experience renovating an abandoned home in Detroit into a book deal.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Ron Jolly's conversation with Drew Philp, author of A $500 House in Detroit.
That, to me, seemed like a lonely existence at first. And maybe I'm thinking of Tom Hanks and Wilson and his volleyball, you know, and you had that screwdriver. But no, it did seem to move downtown. You didn't bring your friends, girlfriend, family. It was just you, and then you moved into this neighborhood all by yourself. You made friends, but that takes a little while to warm up and actually feel that relationship. So you stuck to it there. What was the biggest challenge for you construction-wise with the house?
The heat, really. The heat. So I lived without heat for 2 years, as I just imagined, almost 2 years. As I just mentioned, and that cold just works its way into you. It was something that I both wanted to do and needed to do. I legitimately did not have the money for heat. And the house in which I was staying, the people were letting me rent for free for looking after it, but it didn't have heat. And that was really tough. I was eating incredible amounts of food because you don't realize how much your body is a furnace until you don't have heat. I lost all kinds of weight just trying to keep myself warm. And just the brutal, unending cold of Michigan winters, you know, gets to you. You know, I'd take the like 15, 20 minute showers because it would be the warmest part of my day. I would, you know, sleep in my Carhartt jacket underneath so many blankets my dad thought I was going to asphyxiate.
Yeah. So you finally got heat, though, and again, Drew, if you read the book here, he wanted to do this on his own with integrity. You didn't want to go buy cheap materials made in Asia at the big box store. You wanted to patronize the locals. You wanted to salvage and reuse whatever you could, and you had a lot of pride in doing it, with help from your community, of course, your friends. But then your dad and your grandma kind of blew that by saying, we bought you a furnace.
They did. They did. So that's how I got a furnace. And at the time, I was, you know, I wanted to do it myself. But I learned an important lesson there. And it took me a while to realize this, you know, that being part of a community doesn't mean just giving because I'm the baddest dude in town, you know, and I'm helping everybody and helping myself. It means accepting graciously, too. And that was something that, you know, it took me a while to learn, and I try to remember that now. You know, who am I to not take a gift or something like that?
So that's probably one of the many things you learned through this experience.
I learned a lot of things. Yeah. I had a lot of growing up to do.
But yeah, it was, you shared that brilliantly in the book, by the way. So when did you start writing about this? I mean, did you keep a blog or a journal, or when did you decide to tell this story?
Sure. I kept journals throughout, just as a habit to, you know, things would be rattling around in my brain, and to not go insane, I would write them down. So I was working on a film and had the film fall through, and most importantly, I had the money from that film fall through, and I really needed a job. I took a job writing advertising copy for like lawyers' websites. It was awful.
Call 1-800.
No offense to the lawyers out there, but it wasn't my favorite thing to do. And so during in my downtime at that job, I wrote a pitch to BuzzFeed, the website, about, you know, just my story about building my house and how Detroit was changing and what that had to do with the rest of the United States and in the world in a lot of cases. And eventually BuzzFeed accepted that pitch. It took quite a long time writing a story. I think I wrote it like a 6,500-word story, mm-hmm. which took people about as long as a TV show to read. Mm. It was very long. And about 2 million people read that story in just a couple of days.
So that means on the internet, I mean, for those who don't surf or play on the web a lot, if I read it and say, man, I'm really impressed by this, I might put it on my Facebook page and share it with others. So it just passed around. 2 million people read it.
Yeah, approximately. It wasn't quite 2 million people, but you know, approximately. Lots and lots of people read it.
Lots of people read it. Yeah, that's a big audience.
and so that was the first time I'd written about my story. And from that, I had a number of agents contact me. And from that, we wrote a book proposal and sold the book. I had been a journalist before that. I'd worked for the Free Press and Bakersfield, California, and a great newspaper in California as an intern. And so I had some writing experience beforehand.
So again, it goes to graduating from the University of Michigan, proud to have one of the first people in your family, one of the first to get a college degree?
My parents went to college.
Okay. Yeah. Well, one of the first generations there, but University of Michigan, notable university. Deciding to move downtown to the Cass Corridor, not really sure why, meeting people, crack dealers, going to the Halloween party alone dressed as an organ grinder and meeting a monkey who owned a house and knew the process to buy a house, which is what you wanted to do, and hanging out and peddling around and finding the house and then surviving how many years was it, 2-3 years?
Before I wrote that BuzzFeed story?
From the time you got the house till the time it was pretty much completed.
So I'm still working on it. You know, it's never really going to be done, right? Anybody's built this, so my grandfather built his own house, my uncle built his own house, and my grandfather just cut his thumb off on the table saw at 90 something, or not all the way off, but my grandma made him go to the hospital, you know, and he's still moving walls 2 feet, right? Because he just wants it a little bit better. It's very nice and very comfortable and mostly done. But
all of that, and then to say, well, I think I'm going to make a pitch to BuzzFeed. They accept it. People love it. Agents contact you. You don't call them. The publishing literature agents call literary agents contact you, and it turns out it's a good idea because there's a bidding war.
Sure.
You get a contract, there's the book.
There was the writing of the book in between that, which was the difficult
part. Well, I was
going
to ask. That's what I was going to ask about. So how does writing a book compare to rehabbing a Queen Anne?
So I thought it was going to be super easy, right? After doing the house, I was like, oh, this is going to be a breeze. I just got to write it all down. Writing the book was way harder than doing the actual house. Writing the book is definitely the hardest thing that I have ever done.
What was difficult about that?
I don't know. You have to spend a lot of time alone, and you really have to like the person that you're with when you're alone. So I would spend literally weeks without talking to anybody. I could do 2 weeks, and I think it kind of altered my personality, actually. I'm much more of an introvert now than I was, believe it or not. Just to dredge up do that emotional labor and dredge up those memories and be in that place, and the, you know, heartache, but also accomplishments, it's exhausting. It's exhausting to relive those things over again and relive them, you know, for the benefit of somebody else and try to draw these lessons and things to make a positive impact on my community.
Do you have to decide, too, how much you want to reveal about your life?
Sure.
I mean, you shared a bit about an intimate relationship you had with somebody and about a lot of your emotions, but at some point as a writer, do you say, oh, that's mine, I'm not sharing that?
If I can be of use to the world, I try to do that. I don't try to do anything gratuitously, but you know, if it's they say that you should write about what you don't want to write about because that's important. So, you know, with some of these things, if I can be of use, I try to offer what I can. That's how they let poor kids write. They let you write about yourself. You got to write about yourself first before they'll let you write about anything else.
Did you do an outline, or did the publisher, the editor, give you an idea of how to work your way through this?
So I had had some training in terms of structuring long form things like this when I was doing movies. So okay. That was also an interesting story where I was working at the Free Press had spelled my byline wrong. And I was working at as a result, I started working at a French restaurant in town. It was this wild place. It was this guy, this like 8 foot tall French soccer star, married a Detroit woman and opened this like weird French cafe in the middle of this like industrial neighborhood. It was wild and a whole lot of fun. Anyways, I was working as a chef, and it was an open kitchen, so we would kind of talk to the patrons, and there's this one gentleman that would come in every day. And he would order the exact same thing every day, and I still remember what his order was. It was a ham and Swiss crepe with a fruit salad instead of a regular salad. Wouldn't fail. And, you know, one day we got talking, and he said, I'm a filmmaker. I have this very short script. I can't pay you, but do you want to look at it? And I was like, yeah, sure, I'm not doing anything. So I gave him some notes and changed some things around and gave it back to him. He said, oh, that was a test. Do you want a job? And I said, yes, I do. So he paired me with himself, who was a good and an Emmy-winning filmmaker, Michigan winning filmmaker, and I learned a lot about structure that way.
Okay.
And then so when we built the proposal that my agent sold, that there was a structure in that proposal, what kind of every chapter was going to look like.
Okay.
By the end of the book, none of that structure remained at all. it was much different. I have a wonderful, brilliant editor named Colin Harrison, who's kind of a legend in the business, and he really was very nice and helped me through things. And the first time I talked to him, on the phone about the book, I'd met him once before, he said, you know, I'm really sorry to do this, but we're totally going to blow the structure of your book up. I said, okay, I'll listen to whatever you have to say.
So I remember in the book, right about the time you got the furnace from your dad and grandmother, you write about your parents are over there, and they're in the house helping you clean up or do something, and they have their coats on, and it's freezing, and they're saying, you can't live like this anymore.
Right.
And you're the one that they sent to college and decided not to do anything with your degree, traditionally. And now you're living in this house. What do they think of you now?
Oh, they're so excited. They're so happy. So I, like I said, I had weird, strange parents who used to send me like NAACP meetings so I could get, I grew up in a very small place, and they recognized that. And like when we went on vacation, they took us to Europe once, and we went to like Dachau concentration camp so we could see how the world works. We took all these like educational vacations, Colonial Williamsburg. If you've never been to Colonial Williamsburg, it is sweet. So they have always been extremely supportive. But as I tell young writers, if there's any young writers in here, there's a point in every writer's life where the only person that believes in you is you. Even my parents, who are the best parents in the world, there was a point where they're like, you should probably get a job. So there were some low points, but they of course they're super proud. They like watch me on TV and look up all this stuff, and they want to talk about it. And I'm like, it's weird, I don't want to. But they, I love them very much. I could not have asked for better parents.
What did building the house? I say building it. Rehabbing it, but it really was more like a construction job.
So I say building because everything is new.
What did that do for you, that young 23-year-old, maybe a bit idealistic, maybe a bit naive, and after accomplishing that, what did it do for you? It must have given you confidence to go out and deal with the world like this and sit on a stage and talk to people.
I suppose it does. What it gave me was discipline. Right? I needed discipline to be able to, I didn't have anybody except Old Man Winter kind of chasing me to get things done on my house. I needed to learn how to do that. And at the end of the day, nobody can take that away from me, what I've done there. If the house, burns down or for some reason it gets taken in eminent domain or something, you can never really take away the hard muscles that I got from lifting everything or the strong brain from figuring things. And certainly that gives me a confidence that no matter what happens, I'll always have. I live in my conception.
Right? Yeah.
I live in an idea that I had.
It didn't take you 30 years to pay it off either.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, you know. I did sweat equity. So I'm especially young people, and I hope there's some young people in the audience hearing this. You know, you don't have to follow the path that everyone has told you, which was, you know, go to school and get good grades and go to college and take out a bunch of debt and then get a house with a mortgage and take out more debt and get, you know, maybe you can get a good job and maybe at 70, if everything goes perfectly, you can retire. There are other ways to do things. And they will give you benefits, not just in the house. Like, it's great. People ask what the house is worth, and I say, whatever you pay in rent every month. That's what the house is worth. Whatever your mortgage is every month, that's what my house is worth every month because I don't pay it. There are other ways of existing and living here, and I think we're going to need to find those if we're to be successful in the 21st century.
Well, what do you in Detroit now, what, I don't know, what do you have a vision of what Detroit will or should look like in, say, 10 years, or what would you like to see? Because a lot of people, the headlines are very positive right now. Mm-hmm. Travel Michigan is talking about it, it's making top 10 lists,
but good.
It's the downtown district.
Sure.
It's the restaurants, the stadiums, the riverfront, the linear park along the river, but getting outside of that, there's another 140 square miles.
Sure.
Of maybe neighborhoods like yours that are, you know, coming back, but we need, so what do you think should be done?
So I'm not necessarily the person to decide what should be done. Like a young white person that's moved in there, right? What I don't want to do is do what we've always done before. I do not want to make the same mistakes of the past. And I suppose in some of our decisions, like the one with the hockey stadium that I mentioned earlier, we're making some of the same mistakes of the past. I want to try something new. This is a new century. And we get to decide what that is. We don't have to do it how we did it before. We don't have to follow that same model. We can come up with whatever we want. And I think we need to have some difficult, but I think fruitful conversations amongst ourselves about who we want to be as a people. And our politicians should not lead these conversations. And I say that honestly, you know. Thank you. We need to have these conversations without the greed and the avarice that goes on. And we can do it, too. I think that in some ways we forgot how powerful we are as citizens and individuals of this country. You know, I get to speak in a lot of places like this, and I look around and I see brilliant, caring people that aren't nearly as divided as mm-hmm. we talk about. I think that's manufactured, and I think we have to remember, we put a man on the moon.
Right.
I mean, think about that. Like, really, like, think about it. Like, for me, it's incredible. People have been looking up at the moon forever. And the United States did that. And we can't figure out healthcare? Come on. Like, honestly, you know? Like, we can do it. There is sometimes a defeatism which has infected us a little bit. And I don't think that's metastasizing or spreading. I think that we can really look at who we want to be, and I think that we can really come to terms with that.
I tell you, your generation has, I hope they stop imitating who's come before them. Sure. And look at ideas and say, we can do it anything we want now.
Sure.
You have new technology and all kinds of ideas. So the old Detroit you mentioned was the home of the first middle class, thanks to the auto industry jobs,
sure.
which is, it's still there, but it's not what it used to be, nor will it ever probably.
Sure.
Gilbert is downtown with the mortgage place. What's that?
Quicken Loans.
I don't know if CompuWare is still down there, but can Detroit be something that offers a place to live for people without a core industry, do you think?
I think we don't want to have mono industry again,
yeah.
right? So that's one of the mistakes I don't think we want to repeat. I think we want to have a diverse industry. With that said, there's no reason Detroit can't be solar panel city. There's no reason Detroit can't be Windmill City. We have a large manufacturing base still with a lot of people that want to that need jobs and understand how manufacturing works. And I don't think there's any reason we can't subsidize the hell out of green energy and do it right in Detroit.
Yeah. Could be the entrepreneur capital, too.
Absolutely.
You could just say, if you have an idea for a business, come here and do it.
And this is one, and this is, like I'm saying, this is just one idea, and I'm not the only person that should or can decide what that needs to be. We need to have a conversation, because I'm only one mind. There's a lot of other brilliant people, but we have to support that. We have to, as both a society and our governments, have to support and put money behind those things instead of just giving it to billionaires.
So in Detroit now, do you think racially that it is as divided as it would appear in popular media? Or, I mean, you talk about living, your block, I don't know, your block, you moved in, there were a lot of black neighbors.
Sure.
That you wanted to ingratiate yourself to and felt like you kind of had to prove, like...
Absolutely.
Yeah. So if you live there in Detroit, is there some solidarity between Detroiters, or is it still split white and black?
So Detroit is the most segregated metro area in the United States by race. Without a doubt, it's not in the South, it's Detroit. So there are still enormous racial divides going on there in the region. In some cases, there are walls, literal walls, that separate white and black that run right across municipal streets. It's a very famous one called the Burwood Wall that was built literally to keep black people out of the suburbs. So there are enormous problems and questions around this. This is America's original sin, and this is the thing that we need to figure out as dealing with economics. One thing I'm fearful of is that segregation is moving back to the city as well. 10 years ago, I was not able to go to any place that was all white people. And now that can happen. With that said, I think that especially young people are trying to figure out how to break these things. I don't necessarily think we're doing a great job at that, but people are talking, I think, for the first time in a long time. We've got into this problem over 400 years, at least. And we're not gonna solve it tomorrow. You know, we're not gonna solve it all at once. However, young white people especially are really thinking about what we do about this uniquely American tragedy, especially in Detroit.
If you're a young guy, white or black, you happen to be white, and you went downtown as a 23-year-old, spent $500 on a house, a lot of sweat equity, but you did have to put money into it. Do you hope to inspire, or should that be inspiring other people, middle-class families that have your skills?
Sure.
White or black, to say, hey, why are we paying a 30-year mortgage? Let's go grab one of those abandoned homes or $3,000 homes, and they would own a home immediately,
sure,
and a very livable home within years.
Sure.
Do you see that, or do you hope to
see
that?
Absolutely. I mean, it's happening a lot in Detroit, but I tell people that it doesn't have to happen in Detroit, right? So I get calls quite often from people who have been foreclosed on and are looking for some place to live. I mean, the foreclosure crisis, again, that's one in three people in Detroit, one in three homes in Detroit, is not just in Detroit. I said Detroit is like America without the volume turned all the way up. So it's like wild there. But we still haven't dealt with the foreclosure crisis in America. If people want to come to Detroit and be part of the community, that's great, that's sweet. But there's also all kinds of houses in Saginaw that are abandoned. There are all kinds of houses in the rural areas out here that are abandoned in Lenawee County, where I come from, that are abandoned. I see them. It doesn't have to be in Detroit. You can do it wherever you're from and wherever you want. Of course we want people in Detroit. The city very simply needs more people. It's built for almost twice the amount of people that live there. But yeah. People can do, there's a lot to do in one's own community, even here in Traverse City. Think about this state theater, right?
State theater and the state hospital, both.
The state hospital. Those were huge community efforts. I see it here, and we need more of that. What I talk about in Detroit is the sense of radical neighborliness, right? And this is an idea that, like, I stole from the Bible. It's, like, not even new, you know? I think that's what we need more of, and people knowing their neighbors. When vast amounts of white people moved out of Detroit to the suburbs, what they traded for security was community. And I think that we need to get back to that. This is why I think young people are moving to cities, because they're looking for that. They want to know their neighbors. They want to be around a lot of people to be able to get things done. And I think we could do a whole lot worse than getting to know our neighbors. Yeah.
And you went down there alone, and it wasn't that long until you knew your neighbors, and you all helped each other, which comes through loud and clear in the book there. So
and sometimes it's awkward and terrible, and like you have to like go to like meetings and like the church basements, and like it's like super unsexy, right? But like that's what it takes, and like at the end of the day, you get to know people, and it stops being unsexy anymore because you don't care, right? It doesn't have to be cool, and it's cool because you make it cool, right? So again, to the young people in here, especially, like one of the biggest powers you have is to make stuff cool, right? Like we don't think about this as like a power, but like if you want to make like knowing your neighbors cool, like I like ride a motorcycle around and like crash and like do cool stuff, and like it's partially because I want to get these ideas out there that, you know, like the young folks, like knowing your neighbors is cool.
Watching the Kardashians, not cool.
Not cool.
Not cool.
Not at all.
Not cool. Texting while you drive, not cool.
Texting, don't text while you drive either.
Not cool. Seriously. All right, is there urban farming going on in Detroit? I've read all kinds of things. Is there actual farming going on in Metro Detroit?
Yeah. Right in Detroit, we have so much space. It's actually, I think, a pretty good use of the space.
Yeah.
It's a really good use. So there was a professor at Michigan State named Michael Hamm who calculated that Detroit could grow half of their, half of the fruit and 75% of the vegetables that the city needed within the city itself. Now think about this. Think about how radical that is. This is some radical kind of self-sufficiency, where if you grow a peach in Detroit and ride it on a bicycle down to Easter Market where somebody can get it, it uses a whole lot less gasoline.
Yeah.
Than driving that peach from Mexico, right? It creates jobs for people. It creates just a nice environment. It's really nice to live next to, you know, like these kind of organic urban farms. I think it's a really great use of that space, and I would like to see more of it.
So, yeah, you know, people talk about bringing Detroit back. Well, you don't have to bring it back to what it is, which is the great opportunity that people have there.
Sure.
It might be a central core of restaurants and theater and stadiums with rural farming areas and small little neighborhoods. It's still a work in progress.
And you know, around those farms, just like a lake or a golf course, you can build houses, you know, that are nice for people to live in. There's all kinds of ideas. Like I said, I just don't want to make the same mistakes of the past. The only kind of mistake I think that we can make in Detroit is doing what we've always done.
Yeah. Is it true you have tour buses come through your neighborhood?
I do. Just to be clear, not like from like my house or anything, because people are want to like kind of gawk at the destruction and what's going on and maybe see what's happening. We used to call that ruin porn. People would come and like take pictures of the like beautiful abandonment without really understanding the story behind that or having to live next to that themselves.
One other notable part of your story, I just get a kick out of when you obtained your house. The trash that you removed from your house, 10,000 pounds or so, included part of a stolen vehicle?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a Dodge Caravan cut into chunks with a reciprocating saw in there. So what that probably was, the neighbors told me it was like an insurance job. So somebody needed the money and reported their car stolen and paid a couple of guys to cut it up. And most of it made it into my house.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't read the book, I would heartily recommend it. And it's inspiring and is making a difference, I'm sure.
Thank you.
That was Drew Philp talking with Ron Jolly. Drew Philp's book is called A $500 House in Detroit. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Milcarrick.